Before we get going into this, should we just quickly thank Vaughan for providing for us so wonderfully today? Be good for us to sort of address our thanks to you before we start harassing you with lots of questions or harassing you. Or
before you disagree with me profoundly.
let's get into it. And there's a question. Some of these have come in through email before the conference as well as during and even up to the last minute. Does God expect people who do not have faith to act in accordance with his design for their sexual life? If so, what does it achieve if they do so but never put their faith in Jesus? Isn't the more pressing issue is what they do with the person of Jesus, and that behaving in a way that honours God is only relevant once they have come to faith?
Does God expect people to obey him? Yes. Everyone. The fact we don't means we're sinful. And because we're sinful, our greatest need is not more laws, but Christ. And so our first task for the world is not to tell them how to live their lives, but to point them to Christ. Now, I suspect behind that question is a further question. How do we engage with a society that's involved in a debate about same-sex marriage? Do we avoid that debate entirely because we just want to preach Christ to them? And my own view is, no, we shouldn't avoid that view entirely, that debate entirely, because we are citizens of our culture, and we think that God's ways are best and are good, and we have a voice. And if we love people and love our society, you can be sinful, but that doesn't mean to say all societies are equally bad. And praise God, some societies have been deeply impacted by the gospel, and they are better societies for simple people to live in than others. And if we undermine marriage, that'll just be worse for everyone, and it's not a loving thing just to ignore that. We should be, I think, engaged in that debate as citizens, but not to think that the most important thing we can possibly do is preserve Christendom, if it's ever been here, but to remember our priorities. Above all, we want to love people and seek to share the gospel with Christ, because they can be, as it were, a little bit more, but they're still sinful, and they need Christ. So as we engage in the debate, we need to make sure, as much as possible, that we avoid any unwise or ungodly language, that we make it clear we're not about getting a particular group of people, we're all sinful, and so on. Having said that, I think my own experience of the media is, however much one is very careful about how you speak, you will be put into a box, and they'll make you sound as if you're a bigot and so on. And we need to recognize that and be very canny and wise. But I don't think that's a reason to avoid the debate altogether. But nor do we think that's the victory. If we can only keep marriage between a man and a woman, we've won. What we want is people come to Christ.
Well, leading on from that, there's a question. I'll just read out the question. Next week, ANU will hold a Sex and Consent Week, which spotlights the contemporary sexual issues and looks to educate people on issues of sexual violence. In your experience, what is the best thing Christians can prayerfully be doing and saying to make the gospel bear on the issue? How can we lead with the gospel and not with ethics?
Boy, it's tricky, isn't it? With that kind of thing, the consent issue, that's big. And it's partly the mess our culture's got into. There is a sense of entitlement. I think porn has added to that. And but forever in a sinful world, there have been terrible things that have been done as people have been pressurized or abused. And so we can take part in that and agree absolutely with treating people well and that no means no and so on. I was talking to one very senior figure in a university recently who's a Christian and saying, it must be very tough for you because you're right at the cutting edge, because these things come very often into the university world first. And here's a senior figure in the university. And he was talking about a time when he engaged with people and said, well, this consent issue is important, but we also want to go beyond. No means no, absolutely. But let's also be thinking about the whole issue of respect, which is going a little bit more than just no means no, but let's respect other people and let's respect ourselves and our bodies as well. And I think that the mess of our society means that there's a lot of brokenness here. And so behind the bravado and all the speech, there's a lot of people just broken and who feel shame. And they might have actually consented to something, but they feel bad after it. And it hasn't satisfied them. And we can absolutely affirm no means no and so on, but also try and talk about something better. That'll only be heard if we're not shouting from a distance, throwing verbal grenades, but if we're there amongst people, loving them, then they might actually listen to us, and we might actually get beyond the slogans into a more serious conversation.
Okay, yeah, this is really helpful for me. I'm enjoying this. as it becomes more personal, as we seek to engage the world more personally, one person says here, my good friends, homosexuals are getting married. I've been invited. I've talked to them about God's love for them, but not his design for human sexuality. Should I go to their wedding?
That, I think, is a very personal decision. I wouldn't want to lay down the law. And it will vary. So let's extend the question. A Christian parents have a child who decides to enter into gay marriage. Should the parents go? And that's been an issue I've known for some people. And that they're torn about that. But I've known Christian parents who've decided, yes, they will go. And I've certainly respected that decision. Because in going, they're not saying, we're right behind this. And actually, the child knows they're not right behind it because they've had lots of conversations. But in going, what they're saying is, we're right behind you. We love you. And we're never, ever, we're always going to be there for you. And so I can understand that. And it's a question of what are you heard to be saying? What message do you want to be heard to be saying? And you've got to decide what is appropriate, given the relationship and your conscience as well. Never go against your conscience. And so we might end up with different positions and different views on that. And I get that. I don't want to be heard to be saying, we're right behind you in what you're doing in this. But I might want to be saying, but I'm right behind you. And so it'll depend on the relationship. And it'll depend on the conscience, and it'll depend on the message that is being said, being heard.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I can sort of weave a thread through all of these questions, but in a similar vein, what is your opinion regarding same-sex relationships that seem more loving than husband and wife relationships, especially considering the fact that there are many divorce cases and hurtful traditional marriages?
Well, no doubt that's the case. So in saying that same-sex marriage is wrong, it's not saying that everything about a same-sex relationship is wrong. Not at all. They may well be a great and profound degree of self-sacrifice and genuine love. But it's not saying everything's wrong about this. And intimacy, same-sex intimacy is good. It's not just sexual intimacy that is intimacy. And so there's lots good. What's being said is that this sexual intimacy is wrong. Why? Because it's undermining marriage and family, which is God's design. So you don't have to say everything's bad about this. And nor do you have to say everything's good about heterosexual marriage, which is obviously not the case.
It seems to me, like, just as you're talking, a lot of the answers are coming from, like, what we need to keep doing as you're giving us advice is to break free from the slogan culture that we're a part of and, like, get through just the, even not just receiving but even giving very simplistic answers but actually saying it's more complicated and let's talk about this some more.
Yeah, and of course that's hard in a culture that as soon as, increasingly I think, as soon as you... It becomes clear you're not entirely gay-affirming. That's end of conversation, or the heat is there, and it's very hard to actually get beyond being put into a stereotype that you think, I don't actually belong here. It's more complex than that. I'm not hateful of people. I'm not, and that's where relationship really counts, because people might be less willing to put you in that box if they know you, and that's where conversation can become a bit more real.
Yeah, right. Changing a little bit, let's move on to some questions related to singleness. Here's a question about dating. In marriage, affections and emotions are secondary. When you're not experiencing them, you persist. How does this apply in the non-biblical but cultural institution of dating? If at times you're not feeling if at times you're not feeling it, would you persist in dating the individual? What is the role of feelings in dating?
Oh. It's very hard to generalize, I think. What we're talking about is marriage. And when is it right to get married? And dating is not a biblical... You can't sort of put it into a biblical category. I'm not saying it's wrong to date, but the Bible doesn't say anything about dating. And I take it what dating's about is trying to get to know someone to make a decision as to whether it's appropriate and wise and right to marry. And so we're in wisdom category here rather than right-wrong. And that's important to recognize. We've got to distinguish between the right-wrong issues and the wise, foolish issue. So how strong do my feelings have to be before it's wise to marry? Because there's nothing in the Bible that says you must marry someone you feel very strong feelings of love towards. So it's a wisdom issue. And in many cultures of the world, of course, you might find arranged marriages where you hardly know them, and you get married, and then you hope and pray the feelings grow. What I would say, I bear in mind personality. So some people fall in love quickly. They feel things very quickly. Well, don't bear too much on your feelings, because, you know, it's the first time you ever fall in love. You can think, I'll never feel like this with anyone again. But those who've fallen in love quite a number of times realize actually when you first fell in love, you could never imagine feeling like this with anyone. Actually, it's happened again and again and again. So you don't assume just because you feel huge love for someone, they're the person you should marry. I would seek advice. If you have a period where, I don't feel such strong feelings towards someone, that's not a reason to pull away. And that's where we need friends who know us well. I think of some friends who actually need a push. One particular friend, commitment adverse, things have gone wrong in a previous relationship. And so with any relationship, there'd be strong feelings, excitement, and then kind of worried. And then the feelings would sort of go. And then also, beyond the initial euphoria, beginning to see she's not perfect, which, you know, should have been obvious before, but it wasn't so obvious. And then thinking, oh no, maybe she's not the right one. But that would be the case for everyone. And actually, friends needed, so some of us friends went to the marriage. One friend of mine, as he'd given the vows, said, well, we can go now. But we'd got him up the aisle. She's a lovely, it's a wonderful marriage, years later. It's a wonderful marriage, entirely right. But he was overly kind of looking in. And if you look in, you can always feel worries. There are other people who are impulsive and just go with feelings. And you need to say to them, look, hang on, yeah, but there's more to it than this. And sometimes friends need to pull them back and just make them think. So, which is why you can tell I'm nervous about making a general comment on that one.
Still quite a good comment. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so perhaps some advice to people here who are same-sex attracted and single. What advice could you give for someone who's in that situation but seeking intimacy?
I'm a great believer in friendship. And I think our culture is down on friendship. And it's if you look... In the ancient world and sometimes in other parts of the world today, friendship's a great value, and it's just not in our culture. And that's a great sadness. So I want to build up your expectation, and I'm not just talking here to same-sex attractive people, to all of us, as to what we can give and receive in friendship. And to pursue appropriately intimate friendships, which means getting to know people better, and sharing life with them. Just one or two general comments. What tends to happen, I think, is massive generalizations here. Women tend to be more consciously relational. Men and women are relational. Both of them, we're designed to be relational, but women are more consciously relational, generally speaking. So they arrive somewhere new and they're thinking, where's my best friend going to be? I'm insecure until I've found my best friend or one or two best friends. Blokes, again, please forgive me because we're not allowed to talk in these generalizations, and I'm from England, forgive me, you know, we do stupid things in England. Blokes tend to think job. How am I going to get my work done? And actually, they're no less relational. So what tends to happen with women, they're looking for friendships, and you've got to be wise in the friendships you get, because sometimes you can latch on to, because you need a best friend, and it might not be a terribly wise friendship, or you can be overly emotionally dependent in a helpful way, or you latch onto someone that's leading you away from Christ in not a very helpful way. So there's the kind of warning bell, but you need friendships. So be looking for wise friendships, godly friendships, that are mutually dependent on Christ rather than one another, that don't mess you up. Blokes, very often, as time goes by, we make mates, naturally, high school days, uni days, because they're just around and you're single and you're not sort of thinking about it, you just got lots of mates. And then you get married, in many cases, and you get jobs and you're kind of focusing about it. And then as the years go by, you wake up, kind of approaching midlife, and you suddenly realize, where are all the mates gone? And that there's no one in the inner circle anymore. They've just kind of drifted into the outer circle. And when you see each other, how you doing, mate? It's great. But there's no, you're not doing life together. And I want to encourage people to make sure that there are people in the inner circle. Whether you're married or single, you need mates in the inner circle who can share life with you, who get you, who know you. And you're not just catching up every 6 months or so. So for those who are younger and single, try and keep them there. And so when you find they get married, it's not the end of friendship. It'll change the friendship. But try and make sure you keep seeing each other. And as I said earlier, the way to get is to give. Don't forever thinking people aren't being friends to me in the way they should. Just be friends to them. Keep in touch. Give them a ring. Call around. Don't go too much, but be sensitive. And open up a bit more. You want people to really get you? Well, take the initiative. Say, look, mate, I really appreciate if you could pray for me about this. It's quite a personal issue, but I'd really... By and large, when you're open in that personal way, other people then open up to you, and the friendships deepen. Take the initiative and keep the initiative, and make sure there are some in the inner circle, married or single. Now, for the same-sex attracted person, at a younger life, if they're thinking, this seems to just be sticking around, this thing, and I'm now thinking, am I going to get married and look as if it might not happen? And there's an anxiety there. And then a little voice is saying, well, that's it. That's it. That's the end of intimacy for you. That can lead to really stupid ways of behaving or sin because you think it's unsustainable. Think relationship. Appropriate forms of intimacy. And I want to say, to plagiarize a series of videos which are really encouraging people in an ungodly direction. I want to plagiarize the slogan and say, it gets better. It gets better. Because, for me, I can look back on 30 years of friendship with some friends. And they're still around. And the friendships have carried on. And through moves and marriages, they're still there. And so I'm not thinking, well, who are going to be my friends in 10 years' time? Because if they've been friends for 30 years, it's a pretty good chance they're not going to walk away now. And so keep building friendship, growing into intimacy. Some will drift out into the outer circle, even when you wanted them to keep them in. But make sure there are those that you're investing in, and then as you give, you'll get.
Okay, all right. Here's a question. Does the use of masturbation bring about God's purpose of creation, of intimacy and love?
Does the use of masturbation bring about God's
purpose for creation, of intimacy and love?
Well, no, I don't think it does. I don't think it doesn't produce intimacy. It doesn't create love. I don't know who asked the question, obviously. I suspect the question's inviting a no, and I don't know. I'd want to say the Bible just says remarkably little about masturbation, i.e. zilch, in on of itself. And so, you know, it's talk of onanism, was the old term, but what Onan was doing wasn't masturbation. But the Bible has plenty of principles. So, so I want to begin by saying, if there's someone who thinks this is, and some younger people especially might think, this is the big sin, and this defines me, and so on, it's just worth remembering the Bible doesn't say anything about it. That's not saying it's irrelevant, we don't have to think about it. I'm coming to say more. But don't define your Christian life and how well you're doing the Christian life but by whether this is an issue for you or not. That's the first thing I want to say. The second is the Bible does teach principles. And it's sex is for a relationship. And we're not to lust. Anyone who thinks a woman lustfully in his heart has committed adultery and so on. And virtually always masturbation goes with fantasy. And in talking with younger people, I think most younger people have grown up with masturbation and pornography going together very, very often. And porn is obviously wrong and must be fought, and there will be plenty in our churches and here for whom it's an addiction and a compulsion. And we need to help one another on that. And so, and the idea that masturbation will somehow give sexual release and then it'll be easier, it just doesn't work like that. It goes the other way. So I wouldn't want someone to be obsessed about this and to feel that this is the big thing, but I would want to apply the principles and say sexual fantasy, the Lord forbids. And the myth of release doesn't work, just feeds more. And so I think we want to be pursuing sex in marital relationship rather than in isolation. I hope that's a sort of clear and slightly waffy answer, in that I just don't want it to be the big deal, but nor do I want to say, okay, doesn't matter.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Switching, there's I don't have the precise words for this question, but it's a question about the reality. Jesus talks about there being no marriage in heaven, and I'm not sure if Andrew's got the question available. It came in late. Here we go. Is there any pastoral advice on helping married people make sense of no marriage in heaven? Thanks, Andrew.
Well, only to say that the new creation will be better by far. So if you're worried and thinking, well, you know, marriage is the best thing about this world, and so I just don't want to be in the new creation if I can't enjoy marriage there. Well, you will enjoy marriage there, but it'll be marriage with Christ. And then that's not to say there won't be human relating with one another. There will be. And there'll be recognition, I take it. But there won't be that kind of exclusivity, and it won't be sexual relationship. Because that speaks of the greater reality. And so if you can't imagine enjoying eternity without the joys you've experienced here, bear in mind that any joy we've experienced here is magnified by the nth degree in the new creation, and there will be no sense of regret. And if you struggle to get that, well, it is by definition out of this world, isn't it? And therefore, we're not going to quite get it until we get there.
Yeah. We might. How are you going, Vaughan?
I'm all right.
You're motoring along well.
How are you going? You've got to listen. You've got to listen to this stuff.
No, this is fantastic. A question that I think a couple of questions here, and we might have some time to sort of open it to the floor if there's people. So if you've got some questions that you want to follow up, maybe start brewing those in your head right now. There's two questions that I've heard come up frequently, and I'll just pick a couple of these now. What about the argument about children faring better in family with mother and father? This has been disputed by some because de facto sex couples can have children but can't marry.
Just is that going?
It's
up
written
there?
Up so there.
What about
yeah.
the argument about children fearing but not fearing? For that Munda. I don't quite know what's behind the question. I mean, certainly you can have de facto same-sex children, couples can have children but can't marry. They can't have children. I mean, they can be given children. They can't biologically have children. But let me, I don't quite know what's behind the question, but you
what,
might...
What I hear commonly is the discussions in public discourse are often... And from Christian leaders as well, is often around the fact, as we sort of seek to engage with the world, that families will fare better through their biological, children will fare better with their biological parents, which is not, it's not sort of, I think it's an argument that comes from us trying to gain common ground with the world, and so there's studies that are produced to sort of defend this and so on. Have you got any thoughts about that argument?
I'm not a sociologist. I've not done the studies. I've read some of the stuff, and I know it's hotly contested territory. Mm. I think it very much depends on how you do the research in most of these things to what you come up with. It seems to me I'm not speaking about studies. I'm just saying it's kind of obvious that in an ideal, the ideal is you've got a mother and a father whose genes produce this child being together over long periods with their parents involved, so you've got intergenerational family, and you've got a male and a female who are committed, not just by promise, but by biology, to that. That is good, and this is best. But we all know examples of a mother and a father treating their kid terribly, and you can think of a same-sex couple absolutely being devoted to the kid and being much better in that individual case than a mother and a father who treat the kid or abuse the kid or, you know, all sorts of things. So it's not saying that in every single instance mother and father will be better at raising a kid than other people, whether they are, one of them is related or not, or and whether they're single, same sex or not. So it's not saying in every case, and sometimes it's heard to be doing down those who are being raised, or those who are trying to raise kids outside of that situation. And there are plenty of...
doing an amazing job. And sometimes they're
in that circumstance through no fault of their own at all, but they're doing an amazing job. And it's not saying the kid is bound to come to end up being much worse than any kid from a two-parent home. It's just talking in generalities. This is a good thing. This is a better thing. And we don't want to overstate the case, but I'm just saying it just seems to me, in general principle, that's the way it was meant to be.
And Christians believe that if there is actually a fundamental moral law to the universe that you were describing before.
Yeah. And you know, this is the way God has made things. Yeah. And sometimes, actually, we have to do something different. I mean, there are plenty of times when, sadly, a marriage breaks down, and, well, how are you going to do that? Or someone dies, and... it's not ideal. In a fallen world, often the ideal doesn't happen, but it doesn't mean to say it's still not the ideal if done properly, but it often isn't done properly in a fallen world.
Yep, great. Okay. I've got one more question, then we might have a couple of questions from the floor. Okay. This is one that it's come up for me a bit recently, so it's not my question though. But is there scope for disagreement on same-sex marriage in our churches?
It depends what you mean by the question.
Maybe Andrew could produce the question.
I'm happy to talk around it. So, for instance, there'd be certainly people in our church who'd take a different view. I can think of, let's say, someone who's just come to faith in Christ, they love the Lord Jesus, they're not going to be perfectly formed theologically from the beginning, they haven't really studied the Bible, and they might have instinctive convictions that, of course, same-sex marriage is fine. Is there room for the disagreement in the church? Well, If I say no, and that means someone who takes a different view has got to be booted out of the church, no, I don't think they should be booted out of the church. They're very welcome. And I'm not going to say they can't be a Christian if they have a different point of view. So, of course, there will be different points of view in churches, different people at different stages of Christian formation and understanding. But for me, this is not a conscience issue that we can just say, well, let's agree to differ on it, and it doesn't matter. I want to be teaching them to understand what I think is the Bible's teaching, and I'm not going to let them teach what I think is wrong and harmful. So if they take a different point of view on this, they're not going to be in the elders' team, they're not going to be teaching, and they're not going to be a leader in the church. So for me, it's not a matter of Christian fellowship that someone takes a different point of view, but it is something that I, as an elder, want to protect the flock from what I think is bad teaching. So I'm going to teach them what is right, rather than say there are different points of view here. And some people think this happens to be my view, you might take a different view. No, I'm going to teach what I think is right.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. All right, you might have a follow-up question or two from that. Would anyone like to ask a question? I think if you just speak loud enough, I'll try to repeat the question. Yep, Tom.
Hey, Vaughn, thanks so much for being here. No one's on the camera. Fantastic last week. I'm just wondering, how many times you mentioned yourself sort of the natural law of the idea of God's design or order, that if we follow God's best, how do you reconcile that with verses like in Romans 8, where people are in the realm of the flesh, aren't doing anything to please God? And if they're not pleasing,
yeah, it's a different kind of category that I'm talking in there. That if we fit in with God's design, things will go better. I'm talking about sort of common grace and the way the world's set up. So it doesn't mean to say, well, what Paul is saying is that we can't please God from a sinful heart. So actually, even our righteousness is like filthy rags. So he's not talking about what commends God. But having said that, if I abuse alcohol, I will. There'll be damage to me physically. I might end up being hit by a car. If I don't abuse alcohol, it'll go better for me in life. But it doesn't mean to say that, as a non-Christian, not abusing alcohol, I've ceased to be a sinner. At that point, I'm just living according to the way God has set the world up more than the other one, and in so doing, I'm likely that things will go better and less bad things will happen. But in a messed up world, it doesn't always happen like that. It's wisdom literature we're talking about here. So in the book of Proverbs, you know, if you live with the grain of creation, things will go better. And it generalizes and says things will go better. But of course, Ecclesiastes says, well, hang on, it doesn't always work like that. So I'm talking that kind of category rather than sin and whether we're actually sinless in that thing. We're never sinless. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Did you hear the question about divorce and someone who's divorced? How do I feel about marrying the divorcee, taking the service, and what about a single who wants to marry someone who's divorced? Boy, this is it's a huge issue. And again, I want to say I'm well aware this is a very sensitive issue, and for some here, no doubt it will be. So all I can do is summarize, and that is bound to be inadequate. I want to say I think this is an area of legitimate Christian disagreement. So there are certain areas where the Reformed evangelical tradition are quite clear on. So if someone leaves their wife and leaves the marriage and goes to another woman, I'm not going to marry that person. And I'd say to the believer, no, you shouldn't marry them. The separation, the divorce should never have happened. You know, in that case, 6 months later, a year later, they come and want to be married. I'm not going to do that. So there's certain times when all would say, no, in that situation, that's not a marriage we want to endorse or want to encourage. There would be differences within the evangelical tradition as to beyond that. So all agree that you should stay in the marriage, but there are exceptions. Jesus makes it clear there are exceptions. So within, if there's sexual immorality, he's not saying if there's sexual immorality, you must leave the marriage. But that can be grounds for divorce. And 1 Corinthians 7, the non-believer who doesn't want to live with the believer, then don't, you're not bound. If they want to end the marriage, okay, go along with it. And I take it there might be extensions with that. So there are circumstances. Although God is, Jesus says he always never wants divorce, there are circumstances where sadly in the fallen world he allows for it. The question is whether he also allows for remarriage. And there are those who say in those situations when divorce is allowed for, the assumption is remarriage was allowed for as well. And there are others who take the view, no, in those situations, remarriage is not allowed for. And there's a difference here between the Anglican Reformation and the Continental Reformation. So within the Anglican Reformation, the Anglican Reformers said no to remarriage. And the Continental Reformation, Luther and Calvin, said in certain circumstances, divorce is not only divorce is okay, but remarriage is okay. And for myself, in my conscience, I don't take remarriages when there's a surviving spouse. And that, I must admit, is partly pragmatic and partly conscience. But there are those in our church who've been divorced and have remarried. And when it's within what I would regard as the permitted grounds within the Reformed tradition, the Continental Reformers, I would just want them to look seriously at the Scripture and come to their own conclusions. I don't want them just, oh, I love him, I'm going to do it. I want them to know, can I do this before the Lord? And think about the scriptural passages. And if they do, then once they're married, we absolutely support their marriage and encourage them in it. And we would say that would be a conscience issue. I don't think I can say any more now. It's the sort of thing that people need to carry on chatting about with one another.
I think we've got time for maybe one or two more questions. So we'll try to finish on time for the sake of people leaving at the advertised time. Maybe this one and then this one over here.
Tried to, yeah. And in fact, I'm at Holy Trinity Adelaide on Sunday, and they've asked me to preach on friendship because they know I wrote a little book called True Friendship where I try and address some of these issues. Because I do think it's a really big one. It's a huge one for single people who, you know, celibacy without community is impossible, Augustine said, and we need friendship. And I think within our churches, we're not very good at doing it. We can talk about being the church family, but not always very good at it. But as I said, I don't think it's just an issue for singles. I think marrieds need friendship. So I've tried to, yeah.
So
it's called True Friendship. Yeah, it's just a little, you know, 100 page thing, so it's hardly a deep work on the subject, but it's trying to encourage people to think through and try and be practical on the issue of friendship, yeah.
There was a copy on the bookstore if it's not sold already, so you could maybe have a look. Sold. Okay. One more question over here. No. More, oh, good. Okay. Yep. Well, maybe. Yep. All right. Over here.
Can I reconcile a believer going to a secular psychologist when the worldviews are so different? It very much depends on the secular psychologist and how they're going about their psychology. Because there are, you know, rather like I don't need to go to a Christian who's going to solve my broken arm. They've got a completely different worldview, but they've kind of worked out how arms work, and that they, you know, as long as they're a good doctor, if they're Christian, that's a bonus. But I'm, you know, not essential. I just want a good doctor. And of course, our psychology is so complex, and so what's going on when we go awry psychologically may well be some kind of idolatry that's taken a hold of us and wrong patterns of thinking. And I think the biblical counseling movement has been really helpful in helping us to try and think those things through. But it may be that they're just thinking, we are human, we're not just, you know, we're just human, and sometimes we'll be similar. So when it comes to patterns of thinking and anxiety or so on, some of the CBT type talking treatment stuff can be very helpful in just helping think things through and register patterns of thinking that a psychologist, well-trained psychologist, just observed how humans think and work, can be very helpful. And they needn't necessarily be importing their worldview onto me. But there'll be other psychologists who are absolutely trying to... there's a big clash. So it depends on the psychologist, how they're going about it, and what my problem is. And so there are times when some of our folk may well see a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a counsellor that isn't Christian, and we'd want them to talk with Christians. And it depends. Sometimes it's helpful, sometimes it's very unhelpful, depending on the psychologist and the kind of treatment they're engaged in. So again, I can't be general, I'm afraid.
Well, I think that wraps us up, actually. Vaughan, thank you. Let me just take this opportunity to thank you for taking time out of your tour around Australia to come to Canberra to speak today and tomorrow, for engaging with us so personally from your own life, and even just spending time with us, meeting up with us. You've opened up God's word and helped us wrestle with the complexity of this issue, and for that we're greatly thankful. I've got a small gift, but we'll give that to you in a moment. But why don't we just give him another thank you for serving us today.
Thank you.